For February 25th, 2016, it's the Lullabot Podcast.
Lullabot Podcast.
Hey everybody, it's the Lullabot Podcast, episode 181. I'm Matt Cleave, a senior developer with Lullabot. With me, I have Mike Herschel. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Matt. How are you doing today?
Mike, you're this lovely so day. Far away. We need a swimming pool or something.
Yeah, I know. Wouldn't that be nice?
I know. We're back hard at work, back home after the retreat, and we're back hard at work doing some podcasts.
Yep.
We got a fun one today.
Super fun. Exciting. We are talking about Drupal 8 caching and Big Pipe.
Whoa, that's pretty intense stuff. Super excited about some of the new stuff that's in Drupal 8, and we'll learn all about it today. And to help us do that, we've brought along a Lullabot, Mateo Bosch. He's a senior developer at Lullabot. He lives in paradise on the Spanish Mediterranean island of Mallorca. He's the maintainer of the RESTful module, Typed Entity, Facebook Auto Post, the Environment Indicator, and a couple others, including the Drupal 8 Simple OAuth module. Hey, Mateo.
Hey, guys. How are you?
And Mateo heard that we were going to be talking about this topic on the podcast, and he said, oh, I've got so many questions, and he added to our Google Doc of like lots of questions to help us out. And we said, Mateo, you have to come on.
Yep. Rope them in.
Yeah, true story. I'm also going to be counting every time that Wim says the word render.
Oh, man. You just spoiled the surprise.
People didn't
get that from the title. Yeah. So this unknown surprise person is hailing from Leuven, Belgium. He's a senior software engineer at the office of the CTO at Acquia. Worked on various Drupal authoring experience issues, including in-place editing and Spark. He's been working on making Drupal fast for a long time now. We actually found a video of him in 2009 at DrupalCon DC talking about Drupal and CDNs. Mm-hmm. And he's been blogging about it since 2008. He shared a document about front-end performance and other types of performance that he's been working on with Drupal for a long time before it became cool. He's one of the main contributors to Drupal 8's new caching system in Big Pipe, along with Fabian Franz. And he has a 5-digit Drupal.org ID.
Whoa.
Barely. Yeah, I know. Yeah, that's pretty impressive there. He's been on Drupal.org for 9 years. Prolific Drupal core contributor. He has the 5th most number of patches committed to D8, according to DrupalCores.com. And that number is at 792. So the question that we have to ask him is, why aren't you 4th? Anyway, so welcome, Wim Leers.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Hi, Wim.
And actually, I was surprised that you were making the render word joke, because usually people are kidding about bubbling, because I'm talking about bubbling a lot as well. So that's what I figured you would say, bubbles all around.
That'll work.
Oh, man, you seem like you're reading my note. I have bubbling with
So just a quick question. I guess I expect this podcast to go really fast, given its topic. But why is this something that you're interested in, Wim?
Honestly, just because I personally am very frustrated with how slow websites can be. That's essentially the reason I got into it. Very simple.
Cool.
It's easy. All right. So let's talk about Drupal 8 caching. So give us the 10,000 foot or 10,000 meter, what would that be, around 3,000 meters overview of Drupal 8 caching and how it differs from Drupal 7 caching.
Yeah. So Drupal 7 obviously already had a caching system, but it was somewhat simpler, and because of that also much more limited. There were certain use cases that the Drupal 7 caching system simply could not solve. Like there were use cases that were impossible to do in a reasonable way. So the key example here is the concept of cache tags. That is something that is new in Drupal 8, and cache tags are essentially the dependencies on certain bits of data. So every entity in Drupal 8, content and config entities, each of them have a unique cache tag. And so using those cache tags, if any of the data that is cached depends on, for example, node 5 and on the configuration for example, the front page view, then the cache tags for those two things, that node and that view, would be associated with the cache entry. And using those cache tags, we can then correctly invalidate the cache entry So basically, instead of having to only have time-based expiration for a cache entry, or only have cache entries that are associated with one particular thing, like for example, if I'm rendering node 7 and I'm caching that, then of course you know that if node 7 changes, you need to invalidate that. So based on that, you could look it up. But of course, in Drupal, you can compose things. Things can come from anywhere. You can cache something that contains many, many pieces of data. And so how are you going to figure out which cache entries in any cache bin created by any module, how are you going to figure out that they depend on those particular pieces of information? And that's where cache tags come in.
Oh man, I'm so happy that we are doing this thing with cache tags and that we start to move away from Drupal 7's concept of max age cache only.
What do you mean by must age cache?
I mean, only basing our cache in time to live, like caching for several minutes and then everything.
Yep, absolutely.
Let's talk about like what this means for like the average person. So does this mean I can have all my caching enabled, and when I update a node, it will automatically break the caching just for when it's needed? Or how does what exactly does that mean for the end user?
Yeah, exactly that. No more stale content. So that was a big problem in Drupal 7. And many of us actually just chose to ignore that problem kind of and accept that. And so then the end result was that you had these kinds of clutches on most Drupal 7 and also 6 and 5 probably websites where when a content creator, a content editor, whatever the title of the person would be, when they change something or create something, what they would do is have this block or this extra step they had to do in any case to clear the caches to actually see what they had just changed or created. And that with Drupal 8 is absolutely a thing of the past, because when you do something, you would expect that thing to be there and not be lost somewhere in translation, if you will. And that is so that is the big problem that cache tags solve. From the end user point of view, from the developer's point of view, it's just that certain impossibilities with the Drupal 7 or before cache API are now gone. This is, for example, the lack of cache tags is the reason also that the page cache in Drupal 7 was invalidated completely whenever any node was updated. So if you, for example, remove a extraneous period in a node title, let's say, that would invalidate every single page cache entry. So even something that doesn't show even a node, let alone that specific node, would be invalidated. And it's not just node updates, but also just people posting comments. If anonymous people, for example, could post a comment and it didn't need to be moderated first, so it appeared right away, then it would just invalidate all the caches. So if you were having lots of comments being posted, then your page cache was essentially always empty. So it's a pretty big problem that this solves.
That's pretty awesome. So does this work with sidebar blocks? Does this work with views? Will this work with panels or contributed modules?
Anything and all of that is already working with cache tags. So that is absolutely supported. And
that is awesome. So if we have page caching enabled, which Drupal 8 does out of the box, do we need to enable views caching like we had to manually do in previous versions of Drupal?
So views actually has caching enabled by default now, precisely because views also supports cache tags, and so it's aware of the things that are inside of it, if you will, so the entities, or if you have a field view, the cache tags associated with the fields that are being rendered, and even the different rows in a view, they are cached individually, so that, for example, if you publish a new node, then the front page view changes, because at the very top, the new node should appear. Then all of the nodes below it are still cached. It's just the overall view result that needs to be updated, that needs to be re-rendered. But if you're listing, say, 50 nodes on the front page, then the 49 below it will actually be cached. And so the view will render significantly faster than it would have in Drupal 7. And the reason we can enable it by default, even for, I think, user-created views, so if you manually create a new one, caching is also enabled by default, if I remember correctly. So that means that you will no longer have to do that manual labor of going in and checking if things are working correctly and in writing extra code so to make sure that that view stays up to date, precisely because Fuse is also integrated with cacheability metadata, cache tags, amongst others. That is all taken care of for you.
That's pretty awesome. I want to clap for you, but I don't know if the microphone will pick it up.
But also, this is not something I invented, to be clear.
Yeah.
So the cache tag concept, I think, was added by Catch, at least, Nathaniel Catchpole. Mm-hmm. And I think a few others. I think Damien Kloip was also one of the key people who got that into core. But so basically, when I finished working on Spark-related things, which I think was the end of 2013, I switched gears to helping getting Drupal 8 shippable, and performance was a key concern back then. Entity rendering, for example, was a key concern. And we had this awesome cache tag system, but nothing essentially was using it, except for maybe literally 5 or 10 things. And so what I worked on, was given the time on to work, bringing cache tag information to every single entity type, writing the test coverage in order to make sure that it is actually working correctly in all cases. And so I just spread it across core, if you will. But yeah, it's a great concept.
So these concepts are, cache tags, cache contexts, they are more related to the information that you're that you're rendering on the page. They are not Drupal specific. Is this something that is this cache tag and cache concept, cache context, is Drupal specific? Does this exist in any other web technologies outside of Drupal?
That's a good question.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I have to say, I cannot give you a very good answer, but I do know that there are other systems out there using something like it. So cache tags are not something that is unique to Drupal. I could look up the cache tag issue. I'm sure that in that issue summary, there is information about where they got the inspiration. I think it's got to be some ORM. So Drupal is not alone, but Drupal is alone in the sense that Drupal is something that you can install and extend with modules without deep technical knowledge. And in all the other cases of the systems, usually frameworks or libraries supporting this, the difference is that you have to write code to actually use it. In Drupal, you download a module. The module comes with the necessary cacheability metadata, including cache tags. And then it just works, literally. And so that is, I think, the big difference, that you don't have to, as a site builder, be aware about cache tags. You don't have to be aware about cache contexts either. So that is a very powerful difference. And I think it was in Drupal 7 that you, for a given block, you could specify whether it should vary by user or vary by URL, that sort of thing. If I remember correctly, this has been a long time since I looked at that. And in Drupal 8, we initially had something like that as well. You could specify manually which additional cache contexts you wanted for that block. But now it's not necessary anymore, because Drupal brought that cacheability concept to all levels and has a concept of bubbling as well, which I probably should explain now.
Yeah, tell me about bubbling.
Yeah, let's first go to cache context. So I was talking about cacheability metadata, or referencing that term a few times now. Cache tags is just one of the three properties in cacheability metadata. The other two are maxage, so cache maxage, and cache contexts. Maxage is exactly what you would expect, and that is also the thing we had in Drupal 7. So there isn't really anything special there. So it's a maximum age that a certain thing can be cached for, specified in seconds. So 0 means not cacheable at all. 1 means cacheable for 1 second. 60 is 1 minute. 300 is 5 minutes, and so on. And so that is nothing special. It's exactly like the cache control header in HTTP, the max age field in that header. This is exactly like that. But then the other thing is cache contexts. And that is also a very important concept. And technically, we did have something like it for the render system in Drupal 7. Back then, it was called granularities. So you could specify cache granularities if you were writing code that was using render caching. Unfortunately, render caching was not something that was widely used, not even in Drupal 7 core, which is also why Drupal 7 contrib didn't really use it. It also was flawed or very difficult, or actually only correctly usable in limited use cases, precisely because we didn't have the concept of bubbling yet. But first, so cache context, what are they exactly? They describe dependencies on request context. So cache tags describe dependencies on data. Cache context describe dependencies on request context. And MaxH describes time dependencies. And so request context dependencies, what does that actually mean? Well, lots of things actually depend on incoming information, like, for example, the URL, query arguments, the negotiated interface language, which could come from an accept language header. It could come from the domain name. It could come from a path prefix, those kinds of things. But also the currently logged in user. Maybe something is varying by permissions. Maybe something is specific to the particular current user. So if you're user one or five, maybe it says, hi, Matt. Maybe it says, hi, Michael. That's user-specific variations. You could go even further. You could vary by session even. So if there's session-specific information. And so those kinds of dependencies are also crucial because it means that if we are caching something, we know the data it came from, so the data dependencies, the cache tags, so stuff stored in Drupal, and then stuff coming in through the request. So things like URL, headers, cookies, the currently logged in user, which indirectly depends on the cookie, those kinds of things. And so given those two aspects, data dependencies, cache tags, and request context dependencies, cache contexts, those two together mean that we know the entire set of inputs to a specific thing, and that is necessary to correctly vary and invalidate a cache. And so those two things are what allow us to cache with perfect confidence, I would say, unlike Drupal 7, where enormous amounts of code actually dependent on global state. We were calling into the global server object. We were calling into the current language, which was also a global, the current user, which was also a global. And that was a cascading effect. And in Drupal 8, we have, of course, dependency injection. And that is somewhat related to this in the sense that you have to be specific about which inputs you accept. And it's the same here. It's the same for render caching. And that's where cache tags and contexts come in. And so given those elements, we are able to do far more interesting things with caching in Drupal 8. And we are able to invalidate correctly, so no more stale content, no more accidental caching of something that is actually user-specific, but we forgot to make the cache keys, the CID in Drupal 7, sufficiently specific. That's a problem of the past, as long as you specify the cacheability metadata for the particular thing you're working with right now.
Wow, there's so much information in there. I have at least two questions. One of those is that from what I'm getting, it seems like all this, in order to leverage this for a Drupal developer, it means that I will need to go psycho and specify all the dependencies in everything that I plan to render. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct in a like it maybe sounds scary initially, but we do have APIs to make that significantly easier. So for example, if you are using, say, the node title of node 5, you don't need to come up with the exact cache tag, which is just a string like node colon 5. You don't need to generate that manually. So every thing that actually has cacheability metadata that you could depend on implements an interface that makes it super easy to get that cacheability metadata and to just associate it with the render array that you're building. So it's just a matter of adding the entity that you're depending on to the render array, and it's taken care of. So it is something that you need to be aware of all the time, but that is also then where things are paid off in the longer run.
Right, and that leads to my second question. Do you foresee any added benefit of specifying all this metadata to this information that we plan to put on the screen or wherever you want to put this?
Yeah. So I think the biggest benefit that we have so far in core is the dynamic page cache module, which is kind of like Offcash, but without all the pain. Maybe we should talk more about that later. But that is the thing that is already in core, and that is possible thanks to all that cacheability metadata, because the dynamic page cache module can then figure out automatically which parts of the page are very dynamic, for example, user-specific, and which are not. So that makes it so that we can cache things much at larger levels, so that we have to do less work. And that is entirely thanks to cacheability metadata. But then we can go further, and that's where the other subject of the podcast comes in, which is BigPipe. And that is also very strongly dependent on all that cacheability metadata. So we give Drupal metadata, just like from a SQL database, you give it an index, which is also something you need to specify, and then MySQL can optimize queries. You don't build a query plan for your queries manually, right? Unless you guys are absolute wizards at writing C code, maybe. But so that is kind of the best analogy. We give it metadata that is associated with a particular small thing that you're working on right now, and then it bubbles up, and Drupal can make smarter decisions automatically. So you don't have to write enormously complex code to optimize performance. Does that make sense?
It does. So explain to me a little bit about how things have changed since Drupal 7 was released, about where this cache is actually being stored.
That is, I think, very similar to Drupal 7. So you had we in Drupal 7 already had that, but in Drupal 8 it's significantly improved. You have the ability to change the backend for a cache. So by default, Drupal will cache things in the database. But if you have something else like Redis or Memcache, you can easily plug that in and just change where the data is stored. I think that's what you were asking, right?
Yeah, I think so. I thought there was actually some advent in PHP that was a Memcache-like in a newer version of PHP.
Yeah, so that is not something that is entirely new in PHP land. It's existed for a long time. So that's the opcache. Sorry,
that's opcache. What I was going for. I couldn't come up with a name.
Yeah, it's not opcache. I misspoke, actually. It's APCU. The APC.
That's
user.
More like it. Yeah, that's. Yeah. I couldn't come up with a name. Yeah.
Yeah. So the interesting thing is that Drupal 8 automatically uses that cache, which is indeed way way faster because it's in the PHP process, so there is far less input output that needs to happen, far less I/O. But the problem with that cache bin, that amount of storage that we have in there, is very very limited. It's only in the order of megabytes, in the best case probably like 100 megabytes. Usually it's far less than that, and so it's only useful to a limited extent. And so what we chose to do in Drupal 8 is that to tag certain cache bins, like the ones that are storing metadata, to store those in that cache. Basically, the caches that are that have small amounts of information, like many small things, and that are frequently accessed. So that gives us the maximum gain from using that. And indeed, that's something that Drupal 8 does automatically. So it detects if you have APCU enabled, and if so, it will use that and make those particular cache bins significantly faster. And it's very noticeable, especially on the smaller hosts. So like shared hosting, it's very noticeable, the difference.
That's pretty awesome. So is there an easy way to see what's not cached or to view the cache contexts? I remember seeing something, and this just might be my imagination, on Drupal Planet a long time ago, where you had some type of visual way to view the different cache contexts of the various blocks.
Yeah. So yes, that would be awesome if we could finish that work. That was just a very, very rough proof of concept. And I think this is something that is currently, honestly, lacking. Like, it's very difficult to get a good idea of what the dependencies are of the different parts of the page. So, for example, indeed, if a block is varying by user or not, and what cache tags it depends upon, which how complex it is and how frequently it will be invalidated. So those are actually very good things to just not be able to see, but also to do profiling, to analyze the performance of a particular site. And RenderViz is the thing I came up with. It basically adds some metadata into the HTML and then has some JavaScript that makes it accessible, makes it a visual experience. The problem is that I haven't had the time, and I also don't have the strong CSS wizardry chops to make it a excellent experience. So if any of you guys are up for that, or any of the listeners, I would more than welcome help on that. It's pretty cool if we actually finished that. It's basically what we could do is like the Firefox 3D view of the DOM. Mm-hmm. Something like that is what I imagined, and that is what it currently tries to do to a very limited degree. It actually is usable, but there is no UI yet, so you have to use the web developer console to actually use it. But it is able to visualize which parts of the page are, for example, max H0 not cacheable, which parts are per user, and so on.
So is that on GitHub, or is that up on Drupal.org, or where can we find that?
Yeah, it's on Drupal.org.
Okay.
So can I oversimplify this and think about it like the devil themer, but yeah, for cache information?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And really, all of the cacheability metadata, that really just behaves exactly the same like attachments in Drupal 7 already do. So the pound attached render array property. There is also bubble. Cacheability metadata is just the same. So it also is a good way of visualizing, hey, I have this particular CSS or this particular JavaScript on my page. Where the hell is it coming from? This could also help answering that sort of thing. So it, to some extent, it would actually be very useful to themers as well, precisely because you can see why some things are or aren't being loaded on the current page.
And also it would be interesting for performance audits, because you could see, yep, that, oh, we have this context that is harming performance, but maybe it's not that important to be there if we gain some performance, right?
Yep, exactly. Yeah. Yep. So it allows you to see why a particular page is not being cached, for example. And maybe that is because apparently there is one tiny string somewhere deep in the page that is saying, hi, Mateo, or hi, Wim, or something like that. So, yes.
Yeah, I remember seeing a Drupal core issue where I guess the comment forms or some part of the comment form was having some issues caching, and there was a lot of work on it toward the end.
Yeah. So. Yeah, the comment form currently is mostly not cacheable because it says the current user's name if you're authenticated there. And so that means it's not cacheable until we fix that.
There are some parts of Drupal 8 that aren't leveraging the new cache system. I guess Drupal core's REST module. What needs to happen for that? What needs to happen to have full support?
So the REST module actually does have cache tag support. So okay, it already is associating, for example, if you're getting Node 6 in JSON using REST via GET request, that will actually have the corresponding cacheability metadata. And so whenever Node 6 is modified, that will actually be updated. So that is taken care of, but there are definitely edge cases there that aren't taken care of yet. And sadly, I've worked actually on one of them today, and the key one is access checking there. So if you have a crazy entity access checking setup, for example, that is something that wasn't taken care of yet so far. And so we're fixing that. But it's pretty easy to fix those things. It's just that it's something that the caching system and the effective use of the old cacheability metadata is something that can only happen once things are stabilized. And many of the parts of Drupal 8 were only getting stable at a later time. And so there are definitely still gaps out there. But the vast majority of things actually does work perfectly fine. Otherwise, we would have been flooded by bug reports by now, and we haven't. It's only been maybe five or so things that I know of that have been reported since the release. But yeah, it's something we need to continue to improve for sure.
What does a Drupal 8 developer need to know about this new caching system and the way things might be a little bit different when working with Varnish or CDNs?
Oh, that's a very good question. So in Drupal 7 and before, what you would typically do when using Varnish or a CDN was to rely on time-based expiration. So for example, always assume it's okay for Varnish or the CDN to cache any page for, say, 2 minutes, maybe 1 minute, if you're caring about not having still content as much as possible. Or the alternative was, and that was a very painful one, was to automatically, whenever a particular node, for example, is modified, to generate all the likely URLs where it would appear on and to purge manually from Varnish or from the CDN. And as you can imagine, that is very brittle, very painful also. So for example, if node 6, say again, is modified and it happens to appear in a view listing in a block on some far-fetched page, then that would not be invalidated. It would continue to show the old node title. And so those are the ones that we just didn't fix in 777. So we had two choices, or accept stale content, or do this generate URL and purge all the URLs that may appear on thing, but that was also not perfect. You either invalidate too much or too little, 90% of the time. And with cache tags, that is actually also solvable again. So it's very much the same principle again. This time, what you would do is expose an additional header, like say, x lullabot varnish, and list all the cache tags there for the current response, and then configure your varnish to accept invalidation requests, purge requests for those cache tags. What you can then do is whenever, for example, node 6 is modified, Drupal talks to Varnish and says, hey, any response that you have cached with tagged with node colon 6, please invalidate that. And so then Varnish will go and invalidate every single response that contains that cache tag. And so effectively, caching in Varnish and invalidating things in Varnish is also a solved problem. And the very best part is that the page cache in Drupal 8 is effectively just something like Varnish. It's simply a reverse proxy for anonymous users. Varnish is just the same, or almost always it's used like that. And page cache is enabled by default in Drupal 8. So it's also enabled for tests by default, which means that we have extensive test coverage practicing whether Drupal is invalidating reverse proxies correctly, because the page cache is now being invalidated just like Varnish would. And so we have very strong confidence now that putting Varnish in front of a Drupal 8 site is actually never going to result in stale content, which I think is pretty cool, especially combined with shared hosting starting to provide Varnish as well. So that means that for $5 a month hosting, you can get sites that are updated instantaneously and are extremely fast and can actually withstand enormous loads precisely because Varnish is in front of them. So I'm very excited about that improvement for the smaller websites out there.
That's not something you hear about when you're people are talking about Drupal 8 was, you know, the smaller websites and cheap hosting. So that's really great to hear.
Yeah. We definitely did think about shared hosting and smaller websites as well while working on all these things, for sure.
Matteo, did you have a question?
I was going to highlight the same thing and say that one sad thing that are related to podcasts is that you cannot see me smiling all the way through this Varnish-like page cache.
I don't know, Matteo. Your picture in Hangouts here has you smiling pretty good. So maybe you're thinking about caching when you get your headshot taken there.
Oh, that's so nerd.
I have one more question for you. Have you done any work with Acquia Lift?
Was it a question for me?
It is, yeah.
Okay. I have not.
Okay. I guess I hear you talking about the advents in Drupal 8's caching system, and I think about things like personalization and how much that would be an assist to something like that.
Right, yeah. So it's definitely true that something like Acquia Lift, if it were Drupal-based or PHP-based server-side, then it absolutely would include benefits. And it's definitely intended to allow for such things. It wasn't that we worked on it long before Acquia Lift was even a thing. But yes, the whole point is that you can do personalization in a sane way now, unlike in Drupal 7, where you could do it in a somewhat sane way. But the problem was that as soon as you were doing complex personalization, usually you would not have any caching or barely any caching enabled anymore. Precisely because it was far too difficult to see where the inputs were coming from. And so the easy thing to make things work was throw more hardware at it and just never cache anything, or at least not parts of the page or significant parts of the page. So just regenerate everything always was a solution. And so personalization in Drupal 8 is much more feasible. And yes, it supports those kinds of use cases, but also just things like, for example, e-commerce stores, where the shopping cart is the personalized thing. And that's the thing you don't want to be caching, but everything else is cacheable. Those kinds of situations are also solved by this. So it has wide repercussions and it opens new possibilities, I think.
We're talking Drupal 8 caching with Wim Lears, Acquian and Core developer. Also, we have along for the ride Matteo Bosch, who's asking all of the good questions. We'll get into some more discussion and talk about BigPipe coming up right after this. Hey, Joe Schindelar.
Hey, Matt Cleave. How's it going?
Lead trainer and lead developer of Drupalize Me, Joe Schindelar. Yeah. So I was looking on Twitter. So I use TweetDeck, and one of my columns is Drupal. So just to kind of get a feeling of what's going on in the Drupal world. And I found one that caught my eye the other day. It said, crash course in Drupal theming, FML, hashtag, why didn't we pitch Wagtail, which is apparently a Django CMS. And then like 30 minutes later, it was the same person saying, my foray into Drupal theming is definitely hindered by all of the documentation written for Drupal 7, whereas this is Drupal 8. Sounds like this person, Danielle M., needs Drupalize Me.
Yeah, you know, conveniently, we actually just put out a whole bunch of new tutorials on our site related to theming in Drupal 8. And there is definitely a need for this stuff. The documentation on Drupal.org, while getting better, is still catching up, and a lot of it is either Drupal 7 specific, or it can be kind of hard to figure out like which part of this page is talking about Drupal 7 and which is talking about Drupal 8. I totally understand that. I spent a lot of time over the last couple of months poring over that documentation and trying to figure out what's changed between Drupal 7 and Drupal 8 and trying to upgrade things on Drupal.org as I went, and using that as a way to create a list of all the tutorials that we're going to release on our site. And yesterday, Wednesday, the first, I think like 30, maybe 35 of those tutorials got published on the site, which is pretty exciting.
35 tutorials all about Drupal 8 theming. That sounds pretty comprehensive.
Yeah, it is. It's what's published on the site right now, I would say, is what we consider to be phase one of our theming guide. It should be everything that you need to know to kind of get started creating a theme for Drupal 8 and understanding the landscape. But this is only the first part of it. We've got probably another 30 or so tutorials in the works.
If I were a Drupal 7 themer, what's the number one thing do you think I should start looking at? What was your most important takeaway making the series?
I think the biggest change, if you're familiar with Drupal 7, is going to be learning Twig. A lot of how template files work and their inclusion in that system, while like the mechanics are a little bit different, the concept is still pretty much the same. You override template files in the same way, and that's the majority of what you do. The syntax, though, of those template files is now all Twig. And so you'll need to understand that in order to really start cranking on any custom themes.
You mean I can't write a DB query in my template file anymore?
You cannot write a DB query in your template file anymore. I'm sorry, but it is kind of amazing at the same time. you'll no longer be able to use PHP directly in those template files. You'll have to use Twig instead. So I would say Twig is plenty powerful. You'll be able to accomplish anything that you should be able to do in a template file, and it prevents you from doing some of those things that maybe you just shouldn't be doing.
Someone should go over to Drupalize.me and get themselves a membership.
They absolutely should.
Welcome back to the Lullabot Podcast. We're here with Wim Lears and Matteo Bosch. Also with me is Matt Cleave, and we're talking about caching and BigPipe. We just got done talking about Drupal caching, and now we're going to talk about BigPipe.
So I'm thinking about like a big pipe. Can you, Wim, if you don't mind explaining something that isn't about plumbing. I know that there are plenty of Drupal plumbing metaphors, but BigPipe is beyond the Drupal community. Can you talk about the origin of BigPipe and what it actually is?
Yep. So BigPipe is not something any of us in the Drupal community came up with. It is something that Facebook actually wrote about, and I'm looking up the time when they actually published that.
Facebook is a PHP site that a couple of people use anyway.
Yeah, just a few, a handful. In 2010, apparently, they published their BigPipe article. And so what BigPipe is about is doing things in parallel instead of in sequence. So typically when generating a web page, what we do, Drupal and other systems, frameworks, other CMSs, most things actually do all of the work of generating the final HTML response and then send it. BigPipe changes things around, and it only does the very minimal amount of work to be able to send a skeleton of the page, if you will. So probably things like the header, maybe the main navigation, the main content, and everything else is deferred. So we first send that part, which means that the browser in the meantime can start downloading CSS and JavaScript. And then while the CSS and JavaScript is being downloaded by the browser, the server is still working on generating those dynamic parts, like, for example, the Facebook newsfeed or your friends that are online, that sort of thing. And then start sending those as soon as they become available. So that means that we can let the browser start rendering things and downloading things already while the server is still generating and building some personalized content. And so that is a problem it solves. It allows things to feel much faster, even if they take the same amount of total time. Let's say it takes 10 seconds. It will still take 10 seconds in total. The difference is that you start seeing something after, say, 0.5 seconds, something useful, or the key useful thing in Facebook is probably the newsfeed. That will start showing up after maybe a second. But then the things that are further down the page or are less important will show up much later. And so doing the exact same amount of work, it still feels much, much faster to the end user. And so that's what the value is.
So is this different than progressive decoupling? Are those two, are these two related?
They are somewhat related in to the extent that... So this is kind of difficult to explain. Progressive decoupling is more about the JavaScript side of things, and that can relate to personalized things being rendered on the client side. And BigPipe allows you to still render personalized things on the server side, and then it being delivered slightly later. So there is some relation, but not a very strong one. You can still do progressive decoupling, as Rhys calls it, even while using BigPipe, because progressive decoupling is more about the instantaneous interactions, instant previews, those kinds of things. And so they are somewhat related, but they're also kind of different. Does that make sense?
I think so.
Okay.
So how do we make this work within Drupal? Is there a module? What exactly do we need to do to start utilizing this kind of cool technology?
So for Drupal 8.0, if you're on Drupal 8.0, it is download the module, install it, and that's it. There is no configuration, and this is exactly where the cacheability metadata that we were talking about earlier comes in. You have page cache, you have dynamic page cache, and you have BigPipe. BigPipe actually layers on top of dynamic page cache. Dynamic page cache is the thing that is similar to auth cache, in that it is able to deliver or separate out the personalized things. The non-personalized things are then cacheable and are deliverable very fast. That is how BigPipe in Drupal is able to send that initial skeleton of the page very, very fast because it's actually already cached in dynamic page cache. And then BigPipe just will start rendering usually the blocks that are too personalized to be cached effectively. It will start rendering those super personalized blocks and send them later. And all of that is figured out automatically thanks to cacheability metadata.
And does this work with any theme? Is there anything specific that I have to do?
Nope. There is nothing specific that you have to do. Not at all. There are some.
That's a good answer.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's the thing where, like, there are other frameworks in other languages usually that also have BigPipe. The thing is that usually you have to write custom code in order to be able to use it. And that is where Drupal is different. We have that cacheability metadata. So instead of writing code, it is specifying cacheability metadata, which is declarative instead of writing custom code. And then things can be figured out automatically. The only thing that is currently problematic with themes is a bug in the Ajax system that has existed for a long time, for years, actually. So even dating back to Drupal 7. But that is currently being worked on, and that is literally the only problem that is known in the BigPipe module currently. So I've been tweeting a bit about it to get feedback, to get people to try to use it. And there is at least 350 different people or sites that have tried it, and I basically haven't received any bug reports. So far, so good. So that was the answer for 8.0, actually. For 8.1, we're trying to get BigPipe into Drupal core as an experimental module. That is a new concept since Drupal 8. So it's a module that is explicitly marked experimental that can be changed more often during the release cycle. So during 8.1, we could still improve it in more significant ways than we otherwise would be allowed. It also signals that it's not something that is absolutely reliable yet. In our testing, BigPipe is actually perfectly reliable, but it's definitely possible that there are server setups out there that are going to break BigPipe or that are making it less effective. And we want to make sure that there are no such massive breaking things that we simply do not know about yet. So that's why it makes sense to have it as an experimental module to encourage more people to give it a try. Because it's part of core, it's much easier to discover, and then hopefully make it a non-experimental module and make it a proper core module, if you will.
I don't know a whole lot about it, and I've heard your explanation, but I'm not sure I fully understood. Is this something that's happening client side or server side or both?
Yeah, that's a great question actually. So it's actually both, but the vast majority of things are happening on the server side, and this is where I mentioned that. Maybe some server setups or just general how the site is delivered may actually break it. The thing is, the only requirement for BigPipe to work is that the response is not buffered. That is literally the only thing, because we send that initial skeleton of the page immediately. Then we don't close the body tag of the HTML that is sent, which means that the browser keeps waiting, and we also don't finish the response. And so then we are generating the dynamic parts, let's say the menu block or the high username block, something like that. And those are then generated, and they're appended to that HTML response as script tags. And then there is some client-side JavaScript, of course, that parses that, that detects it, parses it, and just executed as regular AJAX commands. So this is piggybacking on the AJAX system. So everything that works with the AJAX system will also work fine with BigPipe, which is pretty much everything. And so that is the only requirement, that you don't have buffering enabled. And some CDNs perhaps could do that, or perhaps some servers can be configured to do that. We have documented how to disable it. And in that case, actually, things do not even break. It just means that BigPipe is not able to make things faster. It just means that the entire response, including the dynamic parts that BigPipe actually sends later, is not sent until the HTML tag is closed, so until the entire response is sent. And then the buffering is complete. It can be sent. And that is the only thing that can get in the way, really.
Gotcha. So that's a really cool architecture. So your browser will actually start rendering the page even before the body tag closes, but it'll just continue to wait. And then it'll kind of dynamically insert wherever in the DOM tree through JavaScript. Now, how does this work if JavaScript is disabled?
Ah, that is an excellent question, of course. So BigPipe has some... The module has a small bit of clever use of the HTML meta tags, that is going to only execute if JavaScript is disabled. So a no script tag within there, a meta tag that causes a redirect to a route, to a URL, that is going to set a cookie that is going to indicate, hey, this user doesn't actually have JavaScript enabled. And so for Node.js users, there is going to be one redirect, and that is the entire cost you pay. And afterwards, BigPipe is being told, thanks to that cookie, that this user doesn't have JavaScript enabled. In that case, we can still improve things. And that is the fascinating thing. I didn't expect that ahead of time. We can send the skeleton of the page until the first hole in the page. And then we pause, we generate that particular part, we send it, and then we continue down the skeleton to the next hole in the page. And so basically, we will be able to still work and still accelerate things and still make things feel and so on and go faster. The difference is that it's going to be in order. You're going to be blocking a little bit more, but it's still, at least it's still going to be making a meaningful difference.
So that's pretty awesome. So will this work on my mom's Windows Millennium computer? Or what's the
well
what's the browser support on this?
There is nothing really that you need. Like Facebook has been using this for 5 years, so basically they've been beta testing this for us, if you will.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is a very well-supported thing. And that's actually another very important aspect about BigPipe. It does not require any infrastructure, literally nothing. You don't need CDNs. You don't need complex varnish setups. This actually makes things significantly faster without any special setup, which means it's also, again, available for shared hosting. So for the smaller sites that are still doing crazy things, this is going to make an enormous difference in terms of how fast the site feels.
It's pretty awesome.
I noticed that you keep talking about this parts of the pages that are very dynamic or have weaker cache hit rates that you want to defer loading later. So how do you detect those? I think that by default, those are the ones that have some cache context, user and session, maybe. Yep. Is that something that's going to be customizable, something that you would actually do in regular Drupal development?
That is also an awesome question. So yes, it is customizable. That is a short answer. But I think it makes sense to give a bit more context to how this works. So the thing that I didn't explain earlier was bubbling. So a very important concept while rendering is that attached, so the pound attached thing with where you can attach asset libraries, as well as things like HTTP headers, those are actually bubbled up, right? Because you want the CSS not to be loaded every single time whenever, for example, I don't know, a table is rendered. You want it to be loaded once for the entire page. So it bubbles up to the top of the page, to the response level, if you will. The same goes for cacheability metadata. It is associated with that particular render array, with that particular part of the page, but it also needs to bubble up so that given an entire response, we know all of the cacheability metadata, all of the dependencies for that response. That is also how we are able to do that cache tag-based invalidation of varnish, for example, because if there weren't bubbling, how would we even know what the cache tags are across the entire page, across all of the HTML? And so that is what bubbling is. It's essentially just like event bubbling in JavaScript. It's exactly the same concept. So that is the first thing. Then the second thing is, indeed, when rendering, and so when things have been bubbled, at various points, I'm not going to go into details here because that is going to be far too technical, but basically when things are bubbled, we've rendered the children of the tree, of the render array, we are going to check if the cacheability metadata is too dynamic, if that is essentially going to have a weak cache hit rate, as you were saying. And by default, indeed, as soon as we detect the user cache context, so if something is user-specific or the session cache context, so if it's session-specific, then we're going to say, oh, this is far too dynamic. We're not going to cache this because we're going to put a placeholder here so that we can replace it later, because otherwise the entire page is going to be user-specific and session-specific precisely because it's somewhere deep in the page. And then if we would cache the overall page, that would mean the entire page is user or session specific. So we don't want to do that. So we rip this out. We replace it with a piece of placeholder HTML that we can replace at a later time. And then we're going to render it later. BigPipe then is one example of how you can render it later. And so in this example, we detected the user and session cache contexts. But you can say that any other type of cacheability metadata is also considered too dynamic. So by default, what we also have is max age 0. If we detect that the max age is 0, so if something is completely not cacheable every second, it's not even cacheable for 1 second, in that case, we're also going to put a placeholder there and render it later. But you could change that for your site to say, well, I'm actually okay with caching things for up to a minute, but anything beyond that is even not enough. So if you say things that are cacheable for 1 minute or maybe even 5 minutes, depending on what you're doing, is not good enough, like that is still too dynamic, that is still changing too often for your particular use case, then you can change that that piece of configuration and say, well, anything that has 60 seconds or 5 minutes or less is not going to be cacheable. And you can even do it for cache tags. So if you know, for example, that, I don't know, you, let's say you have a status page, and let's say that's a node, and let's say that's node 20. If node 20 is being updated all the time because you're updating it all the time, and you don't want that anything that depends on that node to be cached because you know it's going to be changing very often, then you can also indicate this particular cache tag, node colon 20, is something that is very, very poorly cacheable. So then it's going to put a placeholder for that piece of content there as well. So it's entirely customizable.
It's very interesting because basically what you can do is then maybe a contrib developer that decided because he or she was very curious that something that has max age of zero, you can say, well, I'm going to cache it for 5 minutes, right? And override that.
That is something slightly different, actually. Like that is changing the cacheability metadata. That is a different thing. Like I was talking about the conditions for something to be not cached as part of a larger hole, for some, the reasons for something to become a placeholder. And that is what you can change. But overriding max age zero, that is effectively actually what the page cache module does. It's essentially not caring because it's the anonymous user anyway. So if there is something super dynamic, it's going to cache it anyway. It's a very stupid, very simple reverse proxy cache.
Right. Yeah, I guess that I chose a very poor example. I was thinking about more like something that's going to make it a placeholder. You may defer on the judgment call that the developer did, and then maybe not want to make it a placeholder. Or
Yeah. And actually, there is another interesting thing that you can do. So, for example, a e-commerce site probably has currency information all over the place. So you can add, for example, a currency cache context because maybe that is negotiated based on, maybe it depends on the host name. So, for example, the Belgian version of a site would use euros. The American version would use dollars. That sort of thing. So you can have cache context for all sorts of things, depending on what your use case is. You could even have things like a cache context for a weekly promotion or something like that. Or maybe there is a promotion, but only for 5 minutes a day. And then if that cache context is there, then that particular custom cache context could be made into one that is considered poorly cacheable, could be configured as such. And so anything that is using, it's varying by that very use case specific cache context is going to be placeholder. It is going to be rendered later because it is poorly cacheable. So you can build site specific, very advanced use cases with that as well.
So what do module developers need to know to make their modules compatible with BigPipe?
So for now, the vast majority of things that are going to be served via BigPipe are blocks. So I think that is the most useful example to talk about. Mm-hmm. It's also the most common building block. I actually wonder if that's why it's called block. Like, if, because it's a building block of the page, that would make sense. Yeah, sorry, I was wondering about that recently. And actually, for blocks, you literally don't have to do anything. So in Drupal 8, a block is a plugin, and it has a build method, and it builds a render array, hence the name. And that is automatically big pipeable, if you will. So you have to specify the cacheability metadata as you would anywhere else for any other render array, and then that's it. The block abstraction already makes sure that everything is perfectly big pipeable.
Okay. So are there any common mistakes that developers would make that would break caching or big pipe that you could warn us of?
Yeah, missing cacheability metadata. So if you, for example, are showing, hi, Michael, or hi, Wim, or something like that, and you forget to specify that this actually depends on the current user, so the user cache context, then Drupal doesn't know, and Drupal is going to happily cache it, which means in the case of showing a username, that's a very innocent mistake. That's going to be annoying if I'm greeted with someone else's name. But if it's more sensitive information, then that is going to be a far bigger problem. So I would say add at least some level of test coverage, which is a good practice anyway, to test that things are varying in the way you would expect. So you don't have to do anything special, just a regular integration test is fine. Log in as user X, test your thing, log in as user Y, test your thing again, check the outputs. Is it the same? Or is it basically not what you expected? Then you probably have a cacheability problem. You forgot to specify some. So I think that is the most important thing. And it's important not just for BigPipe, it's important for everywhere in Drupal 8, precisely because, for example, dynamic page cache is also enabled by default.
So let's pretend now that I'm a curmudgeon. I know that wouldn't be very difficult. But maybe I have a Drupal 7 site that's huge and I'm not ready to upgrade it. Is there any way I can get this good big pipe stuff on my site?
Not in the shape and implementation of how it's implemented in Drupal 8. This is something that literally took months, if not years, because it builds upon all the cacheability stuff, which I worked on for more than a year, together with lots and lots of Drupal contributors in the community. And BigPipe in particular, it also required some API changes or API additions, some things to be better defined in Drupal 8. And so, for example, like we didn't mention that yet, but BigPipe wouldn't actually have happened without the help of Fabian Franz, who worked on that a lot in his free time first. And then Acquia sponsored him to continue to work on it for many hundreds of hours. So I believe, and I was actually surprised by this. So it's kind of, feels kind of strange to mention, but I to me it feels like whoa. So Dries told me that in order to get BigPipe done, which it is now, it actually costed Acquia more than $100,000, paying for my time, paying for Fabian's time, because it's just such a big undertaking. So, given that, for Drupal 7, yes, it is possible to a limited degree in the sense that you would have to write custom code, you would have to analyze every single thing that you are rendering for the dependencies. So is it actually varying by user? Is it being altered by some other module that makes it vary by even the session? You need that to do that sort of code analysis to be perfectly confident. That's essentially what the auth cache module in Drupal 7 also requires you to do. You need to audit all of your code in order to know that indeed this is safe to cache by role, which is a default, or clean up the code to ensure it doesn't vary by unexpected things. You would have to do similar things for such a big pipe solution in Drupal 7, and you would have to write custom code to deliver any particular bits via big pipe. So it's possible, but it's an enormous amount of work, and it probably will only make sense for the very highest profile projects, whereas in Drupal 8, it's going to be simple.
I think what I heard was get off my lawn.
What do you mean?
It was a curmudgeon joke. I was just saying, you know, the people that aren't willing to upgrade see much more of a challenge for sure than someone who would have the ability to use Drupal 8. So
yeah, well, this seems like a pretty good thing that is helping convince people to move to Drupal 8.
Sure.
Unless you are willing to do the work in Drupal 7, then you're more than welcome to.
And it sounds like that would be a lot of work.
Yes.
Hey, Wim, thanks for coming on the show and talking with us on this great stuff.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah.
The story behind the story is he joined us in the comment section of a previous podcast and told us everything we said was wrong and that there were some misunderstandings and probably some oversimplifications on our previous.
Yeah, but that's fine. That's fine. There's a lot of things to understand, so that it's definitely possible to misunderstand things.
Yeah. And we definitely welcome feedback and questions from listeners. And this is one of those cases. We were able to invite the guy on who knew everything. So that's great.
Thanks, Wim.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And thanks, Matteo.
You're welcome.